Ari, what's due in the hospital's COVID ward this week?
All across Florida hospitals. Looks like case counts are coming down, and because of that, hospitalizations are coming down.
Last week, you mentioned that week over week, cases fell in Florida from 85,000 infections to 65,000 a week. Infections were falling at a rate of 3,000 cases a day. What do you see this week?
IHME COVID data for all of Florida, it's on a decline, including hospital resource use.
I understand that hospitalizations are a lagging indicator of COVID infections.
There is a tracker. If you go to miamidade.gov and you look up the COVID-19 dashboard, it gives you a 7-day percentage. It's 22% today. I think last time we spoke, it was 28. The day before, it was 34%. That's local positivity rate.
Okay, so the percentage of COVID tests that are positive is falling in Miami. What is the mix of Delta and Omicron variants currently in Florida?
Yes, the cases that we see are almost all Omicron. Omicron variant has superseded the Delta. The hospitalization change is 33% less in the last 7 days than it was the prior 7 days.
Why are there COVID mutations? Has the virus mutated in response to the vaccines or COVID treatments? I heard a discussion that the mutation likely takes place in immunocompromised patients because they cannot kill the virus successfully. What is driving this mutation process?
It's worthwhile understanding a little terminology. This is an RNA virus, so the DNA virus has a self-checking mechanism that could correct itself more readily and easily. So you're going to have more mutations with an RNA virus. That's number one. Do you know the difference between a variant of interest, variant being monitored, variant of high consequence? Do you know that?
I do not.
No. It starts out as a variant of interest that has potential impact. So when they first heard of Omicron, oh, this is something that has potential impact based on the mutations in the spike protein, this could have potential impact. Then eventually when it actually does have impact, it becomes a variant of concern. So right now, the two variants of concern that have already demonstrated impact is Delta and Omicron. So one of your listeners last week asked about BA2, which is the lineage of the Omicron that is showing more propensity to be more transmissible. The CDC, NIH, FDA, BARDA, and Department of Defense, every week or so, they study what is the variant of interest, what's the variant of concern, let's look at those lineages, and they say what's on the horizon. But as for your specific question, why is COVID mutating? There is a very good article, which might be worthwhile reading, by Sarah Otto in Current Biology. And she goes over the processes occurring within individuals, among individuals, and possibly among species. But the most common accepted reason for mutations is occurring within individuals, immunocompromised patients. Somebody has the disease, you're a factor, right? Because you can't defeat it. The immunocompromised person has the virus and you're hitting it with monoclonal antibodies, convalescent plasma, but it's selecting out mutations in the body for a variant. In the New England Journal of Medicine, look up this article. It was actually written before Omicron in August. It's called SARS-CoV-2 Variants in Patients with Immunosuppression. And they go over some of the case reports. Adaptive evolution is one form of virus will evolve certain mutations on its own in a person, let's say an immunosuppressed person, to make sure that it continues to survive. Then there's convergent evolution, which is seeing those mutations in all different types of variants, meaning the Omicron variant, the Delta variant, the Alpha variant, all had similar mutations because they realized that's the best way for them to survive. And then they mentioned this other type of evolution called saltational evolution, which is really the evolution in the Omicron. It goes multi-mutational jumps. It went from point A to point F right away. And that's really what happened with Omicron. So Omicron was thought to have developed in somebody who was really immunocompromised and had COVID and maybe got convalescent plasma, monoclonal antibody over time, and then developed these mutations so that it could survive, and then it got out. I thought that was a very interesting way to look at it. There's also some literature about Dr. Darren Martin talks specifically about Omicron.
Some scientists expect the virus to become less virulent over time. You hear stuff like, oh, Ebola, it kills its host too quickly, so it can't spread. Now, Delta was killing some of its hosts, but not that many, like a fraction of 1%, and it was contagious before it killed its host. Do you expect COVID to become less virulent over time?
In an article today in the New York Times about Omicron and about COVID in general, that we should not expect the further variations to necessarily be less lethal. So that was a theory by Theobald Smith, who was a bacteriologist back in the 1800s, but that these viruses and pathogens will just evolve to maintain their own health and not die out. So they'll become less virulent, but more transmissible. We discussed this earlier about the influenza, the Spanish flu, wasn't really so bad. It was a regular flu season. And then the summer of 1918, they had a second wave. That was the very deadly wave. They have autopsy studies. They actually sequenced out the virus from the earlier wave, and they compared it to lungs that had influenza to the later wave, and they saw that they were different variations. So now if it was true that it should mutate to a lesser virulent strain, you wouldn't have expected the second one to be deadlier.
Alfred Crosby wrote one of the definitive histories of the 1918 flu. In his book, Crosby described the journey across the Atlantic by the Navy ship, the USS Leviathan, that transported U.S. troops from the East Coast to the European battlefields. Now, 2,500 soldiers left Boston and half died from influenza during the voyage. Everybody got the flu. It was only contagious for like a week, but when the sailors arrived in France, they spread the flu to the local population. Scientists think that the flu jumped from the Navy men to ducks, chicken, and live fowl held in the ship's hold. And then the flu mutated and jumped back to the men. The men got the flu twice and then infected the local population with a more lethal variant. Do you think that lesson of the Spanish flu mutation process has any applicability to us now?
That's very fascinating that you mentioned the possible catching it from... That was one of the origins that we discussed with that article from Dr. Otto, processes occurring among species. In Denmark, they had the infected mink animals, that the mink was infected with COVID and then mutated within the mink, and then it came back and it infected the humans living next to the farms. They killed like 4 million mink. That may be the saltational mutation that we saw with Omicron was actually because there was some possible transmission to an animal and then back. It's not uncommon. I've had patients come to me and they say, my whole family was sick. My husband, my two kids, and my dog, my cat. And I never had a dog infected, but that's interesting. So apparently it's more likely to send it to an animal, but not back from an animal to a human. But I guess it's possible, and it's possible for that mutation to occur.
The historical scientific analysis of the 1918 flu is dated. Science has changed dramatically over the past century. Is there any new learning about the Spanish flu given our COVID experience?
I think you're going to learn more about the 1918 flu from COVID than the other way around. Like, we're not going to learn anything new from that because they have limited anatomy still from that. You know, they have these case reports that they just did 6 autopsies on lungs, and it's not great. It's amazing that they were able to look at the flu virus from back then and see the RNA, but it's very limited. And they actually did discuss that they saw, because they had the lungs, that they saw ARDS and they died from cytokine storm, but they still had some RNA virus within their lungs at the time of death.
New topic, quackery. At the beginning of COVID in March 2020, nobody knew nothing about anything. Doctors did their best. They threw the kitchen sink at their patients, and some things worked and some things didn't. Randomized studies take time. But still, even with randomized studies, their conclusions may be wrong.
Research takes a long time. I think we have to figure out a way to push forward the research and making clear what it is that we should be reading, because all these articles are coming out on ResearchGate, and you don't know what you can trust. I think the personalities you follow on Twitter, you're going to follow what they post. But remember, all these articles are not peer-reviewed. So I think we have to develop a system where we could peer-review things, faster. I think that's one big thing that's going to come out of the pandemic. It's going to be a non-peer reviewed, but this is trustworthy. Because how do I know who to trust? That's a big problem that we've uncovered from the pandemic. So just to give you an example, I mean, I used ivermectin tons before when it first came out, when we didn't have any other options. But when you have Paxlovid and Molnupiravir and other things, should we use ivermectin? Well, according to Dr. Corey and the ivermectin people, they quote this article that was just published in Cure Us. Itajaí is a city in Brazil, and they showed that the regular use of ivermectin led to a mortality decrease, a crazy amount. It was 2.6% in ivermectin non-users and 0.8% in the ivermectin users. There are 113,000 plus regular ivermectin users. There are certain cities that didn't have access to medicine, so they used
what they got.
Yeah, hey, you could use this. So now the caveat is, do you believe Dr. Corey? I'm not in a place to judge doctors. Here's the big takeaway from a regular pulmonary critical care doctor who's pretty much apolitical when it comes to science. If it's a good study, I'll trust it if it comes from a good source. So the universally recognized processes up till now was a reliance on the NIH, CDC, journals like New England Journal of Medicine, Lancet, Chest, Critical Care, American Journal of Respiratory Critical Care. So when I see the heads of those bodies talk about studies positively or, hey, look what's on the runway, then I'm going to trust them. But when I see sort of renegade doctors fixating on one medicine, I'm not as enthusiastic. Like if that same doctor was as enthusiastic as he is for ivermectin than he is for the monoclonals, which were clearly having an effect, then I might believe that person more. You get it?
I do. We hear that some medical studies can't be replicated. That's fundamental to science. And there are certain countries where the problem is more common than others. Ari, how do you adjust your Bayesian priors to evaluate the efficacy of a study that has an unexpected result?
It's not the same evidence. It also depends on where it's coming from, but also the inclusion-exclusion criteria. So if you look at the new studies, the Paxlovid and Molnupiravir, those are unvaccinated populations. You'll see positive studies in a certain population. You'll see negative studies with the same drug in a different population. So a lot of it has to do with the inclusion-exclusion criteria. But I will say that these other scientists who I might have just been critical of, they will say that they've been marginalized and discriminated against. I do think that the New England Journal made a huge mistake when, this is my own personal opinion, when it was the week of the election, when all of the editors came out decrying President Trump's dangerous COVID policies. Not because I disagree with their point that it is dangerous at that time to say that masks don't work, but the point that they took a political side just made it harder for somebody like me to believe that they didn't have any bias if there was any pro-ivermectin, pro-plaquenil study at that time. Again, we have much better therapeutics now, and I'm not even pushing for those drugs, but it made it harder for the run-of-the-mill doctor to really look and say, hey, there's no bias here. We want to say that there's no bias in a medical publication. So you really have to tease out the politics. And it's impossible, every hardcore Democrat, that we shouldn't have vaccine mandates and that every hardcore Republican believes in ivermectin and plaquenil. It's impossible. The fact that they do, pretty much, all the hardcores on each side, shows you that there's a big political bias and you can't really use that to sway your own opinion. You really have to try to stay in the middle and try to be honest with what you're reading and see if it's scientifically sound.
Mass. Certain people have mass religion and some people don't. I'll give you an example of the public being ridiculous, and I include myself in this. We're outside, we get to a restaurant, we put on our masks, and then we sit down and then we take off our masks. Now, there was no difference in health risk, as far as I can tell, between the period of time where we were wearing the mask and when we're not wearing the mask. Behavior norms are established. This is just what we do. This is how we wear our masks. And that there doesn't seem to be any scientific basis. We're just following those norms. I don't want to be a jerk. I want to behave like everybody else. I don't want to be a mask Nazi. I don't want to be a mask dove. I'm just going to go along with the flow. Ari, Does any of this make any sense?
Right. It's hilarious because it's so true. I can't tell you how many times I had the same conversation with patients that have COVID, and I say, oh, how do you think you got it? Oh, yeah, I wear my mask 100% of the time. I had a wedding the other night, and of course, during the meal, I took it off, and we were talking. Of course, only during the meal. You're right. The best summary article is actually by the, you could Google him, Darrell Austin. I think he did a very good job of just looking at the current evidence that's out there, because there's really, believe it or not a lot of hardcore evidence that masks work in terms of rigorous evidence, talking about randomized controlled trials and even observational studies. Believe it or not, there aren't that many, but he does a good job of listing some of them. One of them is the most recent BMJ article. It's a global study showing 53% risk in COVID incidents, but cloth masks are only 30% effective, 40% effective versus surgical masks that are 95% effective. But I think in general, just makes sense that you're blocking the airway and blocking virion, a certain behavior. You're going to be more careful if you're wearing masks. You're not going to speak in people's faces. Besides being a COVID doctor, I'm actually a respiratory doctor, and we saw vast decrease in all respiratory infections when people wore masks during the winter months last year and the year before. And clearly, it was decreasing the transmission of regular RNA viruses. So that it stands to reason that it would work for COVID too. So I don't really know where the mask shaming became. But I think at some point, like now, we have to start living life and realizing that it's time to take off the mask. Not all the time, but there is a time to take off the mask as well.
Ari, we're both in Miami Beach, and we're not in Maine in January. We're outside in the fresh air, and we take off our masks. What is the relative danger of being inside versus outside?
If I really was worried about this variant like I was with the other ones, I would be as strict as possible, I would say. Wear it outside, too, if it doesn't bother you. But the reality is that not only is there a protective factor being outside, it's like being in a negative pressure room, but masks, especially in children, I think it affects learning. So I do think it's time to take it off and maximize life at this point, but also be willing to put it back on should another variant. The big fear is that you start letting go of everything, then boom, another variant comes, and how are you going to convince people to put masks on again? I think it's ridiculous, but that's the reality.
You have to be impressed with our society that in March of 2020, we adjusted our behavior en masse from a normal world to a secluded world overnight. There was an immediate recognition that COVID was, and oh my God, this is a catastrophic contagious disease, and we need to change our behavior pronto. And I don't understand why today we can't be more realistic about COVID's current morbidity and adopt norms of behavior that's consistent with its threat. And the medical establishment is disingenuous, as they seem unwilling to recommend changes to behavioral norms for fear that these norms cannot be reversed if the COVID threat changes to be more deadly.
I think that's a beautiful point, and it was beautifully said. But the reality is, I think the politicians got in the way and really polarized the issue so much that it would be very hard to reinstitute not only lockdowns, but mandatory mask wearing later on. If something happens within the next year or two, it just would be harder.
When should you get a COVID vaccine booster if you just hit Omicron?
It's a hot topic, obviously. First, I'll mention the literature just out in Israel. First, they showed in terms of when you should you get the fourth vaccine. Sheba Hospital looked at 270 workers, and they showed that there were increased antibodies, but it didn't prevent breakthrough infections. And then the health ministry came out, and they looked at a much greater number. It was something like 400,000 Israelis, and they saw that there was a tripling of protection against serious illness and doubling of protection against infection. So they basically recommended for anybody over 60 years old, and they expanded it for healthcare workers. There was also some literature from Israel just came out in terms of kids 12 to 15 years old. The risk estimates of myocarditis was actually pretty significant in boys and not in girls. Interestingly, right? It was like 8 per 100,000 which is a high number, and it makes you wonder, what is the case morbidity rate of kids 12 to 15 per 100,000? And is it worth risking myocarditis for males between 12 and 15? For females, for some reason, they're protected. Not quite sure why, but it's like very...
And if the kids have this inflammation of the heart, is it deadly?
I'm pretty sure there were no deaths a couple days, at least in the hospital. Typically, they'll treat with something like IVIG and steroids and calm things down. The question is, what is the long-term effect of a young 13-year-old who just had myocardial inflammation at a young age? Will he develop cardiomyopathy later on?
Let me sure if I got this right. We give the vaccine to 100,000 kids. 8 kids come in with a heart inflammation. Maybe 1 or 2 have long-term problems. But 100,000 kids don't get the virus. Now, there may be long-term consequences of getting COVID for kids. We don't know or appreciate the extent of the pathology, but we do suspect that the virus will be a problem. These kids' conditions weren't so horrible.
Right.
The 8 kids out of 100,000 who got heart inflammation, they didn't die. Yep, they got hospitalized for a couple of days. But how do we think about it in comparison with the 100,000 vaccinated who didn't get sick, who didn't get COVID, who didn't potentially harm their heart, lung, kidneys, brains, who knows what, that they didn't get hurt in the long run?
I personally am a proponent of the vaccine, so my kids got it, despite knowing that there was a risk. Actually, my son who had it, he had an inflammatory reaction of some sort like 5 days later, and we actually went into the hospital, and he was okay. I knew of this risk of some inflammatory issue. But you're right. If 100,000 people had COVID that age, I bet you the incidence of myocarditis would be higher in that. But that's speculation. Your question was more, if you had Omicron, should you be vaccinated? So that is a topic of the article by Dr. Makary, who is at Johns Hopkins Public Health. And he's a big proponent of natural immunity.
Can you define natural immunity?
Natural immunity basically means you had a prior infection. So you have T cells that are primed and B cells making antibodies already towards the infection. So if you're infected again, you have naturally innate, you don't need a vaccine to create those T cells and B cells to act against further infection.
There are some people who never got any COVID. Can I use the term natural immunity in 2 ways? I'm naturally immune without any exposure to COVID, or I'm immune after a COVID exposure?
That's a great question. I think that the definition of natural immunity is specific for that infection, but you're right, the coronavirus has a lot of different forms. I believe at some point maybe I was somewhat protected because I probably had the other respiratory coronavirus, which was about 10% of all respiratory infections prior to COVID hitting, the other coronaviruses. So there probably is some cross-reactivity, but I believe when we talk about natural immunity, we're really talking about specific to the COVID. But basically in the MMWR, which is January 28th, which is here now, they mentioned that before Delta became predominant, the case rates were higher in people who survived a previous infection than people who were vaccinated. But by October, once Delta really hit, people that had a previous infection actually had lower case rates than people who were vaccinated alone. So you were less likely to get COVID if you had a prior infection more than if you were vaccinated. If you had COVID, why are we pushing vaccines on those patients if they're more likely to be protected from the fact that they had a previous infection? So I personally never push a patient who's had a previous infection to get a full vaccine regimen. I do suggest one other vaccine because studies have shown that you get much more rigorous antibodies after at least one other vaccine. But I personally don't see a need to do the 2 vaccines after having an infection already.
President Biden has made executive orders that terminate workers who are unvaccinated. But you're saying that many patients who've been sick with COVID now have antibodies, and that these unvaccinated individuals are actually better protected than someone who has been vaccinated but has not had COVID. Do you think as a political matter, it makes sense to forbid unvaccinated people from certain occupations, even if they have antibodies and are less at risk to themselves and others, Or is this topic just too hot to touch?
No, I don't think it's too hot. I think that the evidence, I think they're being forthright. I think this is a step in the right direction, that the CDC is acknowledging natural immunity. It's still, even in that article, the MMWR, they mention the implications are that vaccination is still the safest strategy. It still is the safest strategy. But if you've already been infected, do you absolutely need to have another one? What I would suggest, if somebody had the infection in early when it started out, yes, I would get a booster. But Dr. McCarry from Johns Hopkins actually studied the antibody responses 2 years after the initial COVID, and they saw robust antibodies in the people with previous infection. However, in practice, I would still recommend that they would get a booster shot later on, at least one. I'm just saying you don't probably need the full two shots after having an infection. And I think the CDC will come around. I think it's still too early to make a change in their policy based on that one study.
I want to apply a military analogy to our war against COVID. Colonel John Boyd was part of the U.S. Air Force F-16 design team. Boyd wanted to design the F-16s so the pilot could make faster decisions than the Russian MiG pilots, and that decision-making process would allow the American F-16s to win in a dogfight. The basis for his theory was a faster OODA loop, which was an acronym for Observe, Orient, Decide, and Act. I want to use this OODA loop as a metaphor for how quickly our society can build new vaccines faster than COVID can create new variants. Operation Warp Speed was trying to find a variant, build a vaccine, study its efficacy, produce it, and get it into arms before it kills the population. We need to get inside the virus's loop just as Boyd wanted to get a faster loop against the MiGs. But it seems the virus is mutating faster than we can adjust our vaccine loop. It seems to take us at least 9 months, and the virus is already mutated into the next variant.
That's a great question. It's like the flu vaccine. They don't do a study every year when they change the flu vaccine. The CEO of Pfizer said he was going to have the variant out within 30 to 90 days of the Omicron. It's still not out yet, but he doesn't have to have another study. All they have to do is build it because it's already demonstrated the overall safety.
Ari, it's a new week. What are you optimistic about now?
I'm just optimistic that the numbers continue to go down. I see the light on the horizon.
Ari, thanks as always for joining us.